Hello, everyone, and welcome to Let's Go Read. I'm Chris Davies, and today I'm joined by Thomas W. Gilbert, who is the author of the new book, How Baseball Happened, The True Story Revealed. Thank you for joining us, Thomas.
My pleasure.
And, you know, I've read your book recently here, and it was really fascinating because the area of time that you explored is just something I don't even think about, and I think many people don't even think about when they think about baseball. You know, thanks to Twitter, old Hoss Radburn maybe as early as many people go, but you get way back into the weeds and debunk myths about Abner Doubleday and everyone who's been called the father of baseball. What really drove you on this question, how baseball happened?
Well, I always loved baseball and played it, and I'm playing softball at my age now, and I've always been interested in history, and baseball is a great topic. It's a particular sport, particularly involved with its own history that has it goes way back. It's our first sport as a country. And the interaction between baseball and the rest of life and the rest of society has always fascinated me. And so, you know, that's the origin story is really an American history story more even than a baseball story.
And it might be, this next question might spoil a little bit of it, but how much of it was civic pride for you as someone who, it mentions sure. In the book, they're from Brooklyn, and that's where the game that we know it really started.
Yeah, really zero. I'm going to plead innocent to that one because, if baseball was really born in Hoboken or Cooperstown, that's what I'd be writing. I guess I'm extra interested in it because it's so relevant to where I live. Mm-hmm. But, Brooklyn, New York, the first thing that surprises people about the very beginnings of baseball, and you were right to say that it's really forgotten. I mean, people barely remember the early 20th century. But baseball was actually once called the New York game because it was only played in Lower Manhattan, which seems like a shock, but there were other games. There were no real adult sports, but there were other bat and ball games in the United States that are all extinct.
Yeah, and you mentioned that it was only played in the lower part of Manhattan. And I think one of the most interesting things that I, non-baseball related, was how you described the long trek from lower Manhattan up to, you know, the upper east side what now, and how those were such significantly different areas. And for anyone who's been to New York, that just boggles the mind now. A quick subway ride was such
exactly.
A difference.
So there's a lot of transportation in my story because New York, if you've been to New York, this is basically the way it was. In 1840, everybody who lived in New York City lived between Houston Street and the Battery at the tip of Lower Manhattan. Mm-hmm. That's a half an hour walk now.
Wow.
So it's, 320,000 people. It's not a huge place. And, baseball sort of disappears and becomes elusive when you go before the 1840s. We know something about the 30s, and then you keep following it, and it disappears in the midst of what we don't know about that time. But it wouldn't surprise me to discover that baseball was not only, we know it was a New York thing, we know it was played in Lower Manhattan, but I think it may have even been peculiar to a certain part of Lower Manhattan.
That's interesting. Now, you've said this already that about how things kind of disappear, and in the book you talk about the lack of historical record for that times. How difficult was it to piece together the story that you found about how baseball began?
Yeah, so our primary source is newspapers. Mm-hmm. For anything that happened in pre-Civil War America, and it's a great source because there's a lot of information about a lot of things. But you also have to understand how it filters the information, which is a big part of, what I was doing writing this book. If you read those newspapers, you can't assume that that's an accurate representation of every part of life in the city and in America, because they're written for a specific readership. One huge example would be race. So, we know that Black Americans and white Americans were playing baseball at the same time and in similar ways. It's just that when the newspaper started covering baseball in the 1840s, they only covered basically one type of white club, really it was class and race distorted. And how do we know? We know because black baseball clubs show up in the 1860s, and it's not a, they're good, they're competitive. It's obviously not something they just started taking up. You know, there's some information you can get from diaries and letters and other things. And I spent a lot of time outside the baseball field trying to figure out what was going on in the society as a whole. And a lot of the answers to the basic questions about baseball really come from the broader picture. Mm-hmm. So one example is, you know, why did we play this game? I mean, one of the big questions that never occurs to anyone now, but it does if you've gotten a time machine and went back to the 19th century, is why didn't we take up cricket? Mm-hmm. Because it existed here. We had a lot of immigrants from Great Britain, and almost every other English colony plays cricket. So it's a good question that nobody ever asked. Why not? Why don't we do it? And I try to answer it in the book.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you also, you know, tracing it with the everything else that was going on and tying it to recreation and the service organizations such as firefighters. That was really fascinating and kind of all, like a sociological view of how America's cities developed that that I wasn't quite familiar with.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's fascinated me because, you know, people assume that baseball is some kind of rural pastime that was brought to the city. And it's really the opposite. You know, that reflects a kind of rosy, romantic view of life in two centuries ago that's not realistic. If we got in a time machine and we went to 1830 or 40 or 50, anywhere in America, we would say, oh, wow, people who work in the country are working extremely hard 7 days a week, and they have no time for sports, then there are no sports. There's no suburbs. The city is full of people who are working 6 hour days, 10, 12 hour days, 6 days a week. They don't have time for sports. You know, it's not that much of a mystery why there was nothing to play or watch mm-hmm. in say 1840 or 1845. And so a big part of my story is, well, who were these adults that started playing baseball seriously, forming clubs, taking it seriously, competing, practicing, keeping stats, all that stuff. You know, nothing like this had ever happened before in American history, as weird as that sounds.
Yeah, and you bring up in the book the fact that the first fans were spectators for baseball, which, you know, you read this and it makes sense. It's almost like common sense to hear it, but it's not something that modern readers would probably have contemplated before.
Right, because we take for granted that we have sports and that Americans are crazy about sports and we watch sports and we pay for sports. None of that stuff was happening before the Civil War. And, you know, to me, it's actually funny, and I have some fun with it in the book. When fans show up uninvited to the first games between Brooklyn and New York, which excited public interest, the people within the baseball world were completely flummoxed. In fact, some of them were frightened. They didn't understand. It would be like if you were at your country club playing racquetball or something, and 5,000 people show up and start rooting.
Yeah.
Like, what are they doing here and why do they care? And the first conclusion they leapt to was people in baseball and in journalism was it must be some kind of explosion and interest in gambling. They couldn't actually wrap their minds around the idea of watching a game to root.
And if I remember correctly, one of the first games that was kind of called off on behalf of poor fan behavior was with the Philadelphia and Brooklyn club?
No, it was two Brooklyn clubs.
Two Brooklyn clubs.
Playing for the World Championship in 1860.
I was going to pin that on Philadelphia because of their reputation.
Yeah, well, it's deserved. But there's a different game described in my book that you're you're thinking of. But yeah, there's a lot of problems with, but you know, I talk a lot about what really happened in this game because modern historians tend to read the interpretation of contemporaries and don't really look any deeper than that. And of course, contemporaries usually know more than us, but sometimes they have biases. Mm-hmm. And in this case, baseball was, it was afraid of gambling and it was really spooked in the beginning by this idea that all these outside people cared. And They didn't see that it was going to bring money into the game, which it did. But, you know, to go with the analogy of your country club racquetball or tennis game or something, there's all this pressure now of all these people are watching and they're rooting and they care. And that's not necessarily a welcome thing for an amateur athlete. In 1860, a team called the Excelsiors from Brooklyn was playing another team called the Atlantics from Brooklyn. These are probably the two best teams in the country at the time. And they were playing at the Atlantics Park, and the crowd, it got a, you know, it's described as being rowdy, violent, completely, you know, outrageous. Mm-hmm. And when you actually read all the stories, you can't find even an allegation of any violence. And then you read between the lines and you begin to realize that the upsetting thing was they weren't used to having the pressure of tens of thousands of people watching and rooting. Mm-hmm. And one of the teams walked off the field. They didn't like the fact that, this sounds stupid, but they didn't like the fact that the fans of the Atlantics booed decisions by the umpire that were close. And that they were yelling yay when their team got a hit and boo and they made an out. So stuff that's totally commonplace and is considered a fan's right and completely within the bounds of acceptable behavior now was so outrageous then that one of the teams walked off and they forfeited the game. It created a huge controversy and people took sides. And I actually find it kind of humorous to read the descriptions of it.
Oh, absolutely. And like you were saying, the descriptions have their own bias, but also the descriptions take some things for granted, of course, as we all do, that the breeders would know how the game was played, but the game was played much differently with pitchers throwing underhand and you know, no balls and strikes. How hard was that game for you as the writer and researcher to imagine in your head and then put onto the page?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it is difficult because, you know, we all have this tendency, readers and historians, to, you know, it's called presentism. You just assume that the way things are now is the way things were. And of course, that's not always true. It's almost never true. So the best thing, you know, what helped me was actually playing in a kind of a pickup softball game in Brooklyn, which I've been doing for about 30 years. Mm-hmm. And in a weird way, the way it sort of organically develops, it's a lot like early baseball. Because the first baseball clubs, they didn't play. A lot of fans have trouble, you know, they're surprised when you explain this to them. They didn't play other clubs. So the Knickerbockers, for instance, 95% of their games were a bunch of Knickerbockers showing up and making two teams and playing, you know, what we would call a pickup game. And they kept stats, but they didn't actually, they weren't, the primary idea wasn't to play other clubs. So this is the way baseball was for a long time in the early amateur era. You know, it's the another and a helpful analogy is if you've ever seen Chicago 16-inch softball, mm-hmm. it would have looked more like that. So they're throwing underhand. It's a hitter's game. They're not throwing as hard as they do in Chicago. They're kind of serving the ball. And then the hitter is hitting it as hard as he can, and the fielders are all barehanded. And they're just, the game gets, there's no balls and strikes, and the game is won by the team that basically stops the other team from scoring 50 or 60 runs. And that's the way it was.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
And in my book, I tell how that changed because it changed in the amateur era. Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of really fascinating characters that you got a lot of good biographical detail about. James Creighton in particular, you go into a lot of detail about as one of the first superstars of the game. I was just wondering if there was one character in particular that you had the most fun digging up the background on.
Well, okay, maliciously, it would be a guy named John P. Joyce, who was the most important part of the management of the Cincinnati Red Stockings, you know, the ones that are mm-hmm. famous for the undefeated 1869 season. Mm-hmm. Because of all the sort of baloney in baseball history, you know, one of them is that team is, that's the team that Major League Baseball and professional baseball claims as its ancestor.
Right.
And you'll read that they're the first professional team, that they were so clean and corporate, and they rose above the hypocrisy of the late amateur era because they admitted that they paid their players, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they were also a great team. That's not in dispute. But it wasn't paying their players that made them different. And, you know, there were a lot of reasons for why this team, why Cincinnati wanted to build a team, the City Fathers build a team that would be competitive, would be a national power. And not all of them are all that pretty. It's not such a philanthropic endeavor as you might think if you read a normal baseball history. And Mr. Joyce was actually involved in a huge national organized crime syndicate. And I was completely surprised to find this. I mean, when I start researching something like the Cincinnati Red Stockings of 1869, I'm not really expecting to find anything too new and dramatic.
Yeah.
So he was quite an interesting character. I mean, I tell his whole life story because, but, you know, it doesn't shed a really positive light on the whole endeavor. And, you know, his own life story is fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, and there and a number of people that you trace back through their own families, and even to, I believe, the present day, the family that owned the Elysian Fields, is that correct?
Yeah, I actually, you know, as part of the thing, you end up doing a lot of genealogy, and then sometimes I meet descendants of these people, and they often have something to tell you or something to show you, and it's the guy that founded the Philadelphia Athletics. I know some of his great, great grandchildren. And, they were very helpful in a lot of ways of tracing his career and his background. Jim Creighton never married or had children. He's the one that you were saying was the first great star. He was really the inventor of modern pitching. I mean, he had a very short career, but it changed baseball completely and really led to the strike zone. But he died without ever marrying or having children that we know of, but he has descendants through his brother. And when I was researching that part of the family, boy, did I find some interesting things and surprising things. Like, his great-great-nephew operated on my father's knee. and he's a famous baseball team physician. He was the team physician for the 69 Mets.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he was an athlete. And he was named James Creighton Parks. He's remembered as Jim Parks. He was named after his illustrious ancestor. And then his daughter was Major League Baseball's chief marketing officer until the current commissioner took over.
Wow, that is really fascinating and kind of small world situation. I know one thing that was kind of funny in the book is the teams would have their chowder dinners after games, and you put in a recipe for chowder. Did you make it at home and try it out?
Yeah, it's really nothing like clam chowder. Yeah, I mean, I was trying to have a little fun and not make this a boring, dusty old baseball history book. And, you know, I when I write these things, I try to bring in, you know, stuff that matters to people who are alive whenever possible. And, you know, you can read about post-game banquets and stuff, but the chowder, you know, was not just a baseball thing. Almost any group, like a political meeting or a, you know, a militia, everyone belonged to militias in the early 19th century. They would have chowders. That was a good way to feed a lot of people. And I thought, why not try it? And it's pretty good. It's basically a hearty codfish stew.
Yeah, and the recipe's there for anybody else who wants it now.
you can take it for a spin.
Yeah. You mentioned that you wanted to make the book enjoyable for contemporary readers. And I noticed as I was reading, you know, you included references to Twitter. You talked about one of the early batters swinging upwards on the ball and getting the swing plane. And you use first person throughout it as well, which is not common in baseball histories or histories in general. And I just found that to be an interesting authorial decision, and I did enjoy reading it. It kind of made it all a little bit more approachable, especially for a topic that is so remote from this day and
age. That was the reason that I did it, and I'm glad you felt that way. Because, you know, history is interesting because it affects our lives now, not just because it's there, to me.
Yeah, of course. Is there anything else? I mean, I think I've talked about all the stuff that I wanted to. Is there anything else you'd want readers to know about your book?
Well, I guess the main thing would be I wrote it for people who may not have any knowledge or even care that much about baseball. So it's obviously, like you say, it's in the weeds about how baseball began. But, you know, I could have written about the history of the military or the history of the donut. I mean, it's an American history story, and you're going to learn a lot about why our life is the way it is. That has nothing to do with baseball. And one of my good friends who read it, who's from another country and knows nothing about baseball, he was telling me last night, I'm fascinated by it. And I said, what do you find? What's your favorite thing so far that you learned? And he said, now I know where the word commuter comes from.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because suburbanization and commuting is kind of part of the story.
Right. Yeah. That just so many little things that add up here. And again, the book is How Baseball Happened, The True Story Revealed by Thomas W. Gilbert. It is out now by David R. Godin Publishers. Thomas, thank you very much for joining me. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk.
It was a pleasure. It was a great interview. Thanks.